Tonight, I will be presenting the fourth talk in a series that's been going on, a series of four, so I'm the final speaker in this series, that we've been doing on the four right efforts, which is Samapadana. Tonight, I have the pleasure and privilege of talking about that fourth effort, which is the effort to maintain positive mind states that have arisen. To put this particular effort into a context, tonight I'd like to summarize the previous three efforts that were discussed by Jim and Cheryl and Inez, and also talk about the system in which they're contained, in which they have developed. And that always returns us to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught us as a means for liberating our minds, for finding that kind of radical happiness that he found, and that kind of radical happiness that's not linked to the external conditions that are constantly arising and passing away. Effort is one of these eight steps of the Noble Eightfold Path, and it's found on that third tier of the Eightfold Path, which we'll discuss in a second, that area of concentration and meditation. I really enjoy, and I always, when I was... I've always really enjoyed the Jataka tales, those teaching tales about the Buddha's lifetimes. I mean, we might think of them as folk tales. They're very sweet stories, and they're usually about some way past incarnation of the Buddha before he became the Buddha, and they all have some, like, pithy little important teaching that they offer. And I was a little disappointed, I have to say, that I couldn't find one of those Jataka tales that addressed effort, per se, for tonight. But in my wanderings through that wonderful internet that we have and Google, I did find a wonderful dialogue between two of the Buddha's earliest disciples, Sariputta and Mahamoggallana. These were two early disciples, both of whom became arahants during the Buddha's time. And I'd like to just read this to you, because I think it sort of sets the container for what we're talking about tonight. So Sariputta says, "Imagine a bronze bowl brought back from a shop or a smith, all covered with dust and dirt, that the owners would neither use or clean, but would throw away in the dust. Wouldn't that bronze bowl eventually become even more dirty and defiled with time?" And Mahamoggallana says, "Yes, my friend." Sariputta, "In the same way, when an individual with an internal blemish," I'm thinking mind state here, "does not discern, as it actually is, that I have an internal blemish, it can be expected of him that he will not generate desire, endeavor, or arouse persistence for the abandoning of that blemish. He will die with passion, aversion, delusion, blemished, and with a mind defiled. Now, imagine a bronze bowl brought back from this shop, or a smith, all covered with dust and dirt, that the owners would both use and clean and would not throw away in the dust. Wouldn't that bronze bowl eventually become clean and pure with time?" "Ah, yes, my friend," answered Mahamoggallana. Sariputta, "In the same way, when an individual with an internal blemish discerns, as it actually is, that I have this internal blemish, it can be expected of him that he will generate desire, endeavor, and arouse persistence for the abandoning of that blemish. He will die without passion, aversion, delusion, unblemished, and with a mind undefiled. Now, imagine a bronze bowl brought back from a shop of a smith, all clean and pure, that the owners would neither use or clean, but they would throw that bowl away in the dust. Wouldn't that bronze bowl eventually become dirty and defiled with time?" "Yes, my friend," said Mahamoggallana. Sariputta, "In the same way, when an individual with no internal blemish does not discern, as it actually is, that I have no internal blemish, it can be expected of him that he will attend to the theme of beauty. As he attends to this theme of beauty," we can think of all the hindrances, "passion will despoil his mind. He will die with passion, aversion, delusion, blemished, and with the mind defiled. Now, imagine a bronze bowl," fourth one, "brought back from a shop or a smith, all clean and pure. positive mind state, that the owners would both use and clean and would not throw away in the dust. Wouldn't that bronze bowl eventually become even more clean and pure with time? Yes, my friend, answers Mahamoggallana. Sariputta, in the same way, when an individual with no internal blemish discerns, as it actually is, that I have no internal blemish, it can be expected of him that he will not attend to the theme of beauty. And as he does not attend to the theme of beauty, passion will not despoil his mind. He will die without passion, aversion, delusion, unblemished, and with a mind undefiled. And this is the reason, this is the cause why, of the two individuals who are blemished, the one, the first, is reckoned to be inferior and the other superior, the one who cleans the vessel. And why, of the two individuals who are unblemished, the first one is reckoned to be inferior and the other superior. And Mahamoggallana says, now this word, blemish, blemish, what is the meaning of blemish? And Sariputta says, consorting with evil, unskillful wishes. This is the meaning of blemish. This little teaching story sort of perfectly sums up these four mind states. And so I want to discuss those further with you tonight, but just briefly, let's create our own container here for tonight's topic. And in order to do that, we can just do a really, really brief review. The Buddha, when he became enlightened, when he became liberated under the Bodhi tree, made the commitment to share his knowledge. And for 40 years, he did so, teaching others his system for purifying their minds and their hearts. And his teaching begins and ends with the Four Noble Truths. They're the cornerstone that one, in this lifetime on this planet, suffering will exist. Doesn't mean we're always in agony. It just means that in every day, like I've got little goosebumps on me from the air conditioning, which a few minutes ago I was totally enjoying, thinking, God, we're so lucky to practice in America. And here I am. It's not a big deal, but it's just, things are always changing, you know? And so what was completely wonderful a minute ago, it's either nerves or goosebumps from the air conditioning, I don't know. I have to be more mindful. Things change, and it, you know, can go from just minor stress and a little tiny bit of something to major physical and mental suffering. This exists. This is the first noble truth. And the second noble truth, we know that the Buddha taught that this dukkha, this suffering, can come, that it comes from clinging. It comes from grasping. It comes from wanting things to be different than they are. In fact, the Pali word for this clinging or craving is tanha. And tanha literally means thirst. And we know what an incredibly powerful drive that is, thirst. This is just to suggest that it's such a completely powerful drive in the human psyche to want things to be other than they are. So this is what creates our suffering. And the Buddha's third noble truth was that when we can disengage ourselves from this craving, when we can let go of this craving, when it's no longer a predominant experience, then there can be freedom because we don't have the root of the suffering. Things can still be hard. You can still have a lot of physical pain, say, but you're not suffering because of it. You're hurting. You're not suffering. And fourth, he offered us this Eightfold Path, this map for untangling ourselves, which is an incredible gift. The only other thing I wanted to say about that is that this pathway doesn't result in apathy. You know, I think in some ways Buddhism has gotten this sort of unusual rap that, you know, people are laid back and whatever happens, terrible things can happen to the people in the world, and you just think, oh, karma or something. It's really not like that. It doesn't lead to apathy. It leads to waking up. It leads to the opposite. It means you have your energy available to direct it to your goals. And if your goal is to be liberated from greed, hatred, and delusion, this Eightfold Path, this Noble Eightfold Path, is an important map for us to use. It acts as a valuable guide. And you probably know all this, so I'm just going to be brief. But in this Noble Eightfold Path, we have three areas. And the first category in the Noble Eightfold Path is the wisdom area. And the wisdom factors are right view, right understanding, which means we get that there are these four noble truths, and we want to, you know, that we understand that that's true, and we want to do something about that knowledge. The second is wise intention and resolve, knowing that this is true. How do we incline our minds? So right thought, pulling back from things that are harmful, loving kindness, equanimity, generosity, all of these would go in that category. And then after that, we have this area called sila, which sometimes is called virtue. It's sort of our worldly behaviors, excuse me. Number one in that category is wise speech, which has been given a whole place in the Noble Eightfold Path just because it's so powerful and so important. The second one is right or wise action, and these are those categories that we take precepts about: not to kill, not to lie or use, not to steal, not to use more than we need, not to engage in sexually inappropriate behavior, which is very harmful to ourselves and others. And the third area of this is right livelihood. And that's, you know, we can go back over that if you want to later. I'd be happy to. The last area in this little map is concentration and meditation. And that's where we find this right effort. And that's the effort that we take to guard against these negative mind states, root them out when they appear, encourage the positive mind states, and try to sustain or maintain the positive mind states as they arise, the skillful mind states, we could say. I'm actually constantly dazzled by this Eightfold Path and the way everything fits together. I mean, it's like this incredible web of teaching that supports itself and supports our development. And it's constantly, I'm constantly sort of finding one new little thing I want to think about, or something that I need to think about and can research a little, because we've got so many tools available to us here with our teachers and the support we get. So the four right exertions or efforts are an essential part of this handbook that we use for training the heart and mind. And it really is an act of purifying our hearts and minds. The idea is that when we're using this, it builds a strong base for concentration and for meditation. And it also really directs our karmic stream. So why do we employ these four right efforts? And certainly we know that if we're, you know, we can just look at it casually and say, if we're guarding against these negative things and increasing the positive things, we're going to lead a happier life. That's really, really true. And everybody really does aspire on a basic fundamental level to be happy. So this gift of happiness is a direct consequence. For me, even more important or powerful is my desire to wake up, to really truly be free, and to be free of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I have every belief and some experience understanding that this path is helping me do that. My direct experience, not something that someone told me and I have to accept, but my own direct experience over these years of practice. So over these last 3 weeks, we explored the first three mind states with Jim and Cheryl and Inez. The first effort is not to allow unskillful efforts, mind states to develop, to guard, to arise. And this is sort of guarding the mind and the heart. Actually, it's also purifying the heart and mind, because then these things don't visit as much, but not always. The second involves not letting an unskillful mind state persist, and in the text it's called for the sake of abandoning. And in the third, it's to make these skillful mind states, wholesome mind states, arise, and in the text it's called for the sake of arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen. So this is the aspect of developing. The one we're going to talk to most about Tonight is the fourth, continuing the skillful, wholesome mind state. And it's given a lot more text. I love it. For the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and culmination of skillful qualities that have arisen. So sustaining these desirable mind states is the course there. We can see that these efforts are absolutely interconnected, and they're absolutely connected to all other aspects of the Eightfold Path. It would really be sort of impossible to prepare the ground for trying to root out a negative mind, or for sustaining a positive mind state, without being vigilant and being willing to do the work of weeding out the negative ones. I mean, this positive little garden isn't just going to grow without weeds. They're always going to be there. And, at least they're always going to be there until the final liberation, I've heard. You know, this I don't have any personal experience with, but I do know that the texts say that we will always have these developments of mind. It's not personal. I mean, it's just not personal. These things visit us. And the question is, do we roll out the red carpet for a negative mind state, you know, invite the mind state in and set it at our table, or like that wise little pig and the three pigs, that third smart pig, you know, do you build a strong house, maintain that house, and lock the door tight when the wolf shows up? I mean, these are sort of options people have. I mean, that little folktale, his brothers didn't do such a good job. They were lucky he was around later on. So how do we train our hearts and minds to encourage the visitations of these positive and wholesome mind states? That's what we're asking tonight. And why would we want to do this? This again goes back, of course, to the first step in the Eightfold Path, that of right view, and in which we understand its benefits, or we have faith in these benefits, because we've seen people further along on the path than us, our teacher here, who demonstrates these really pretty strong characteristics that we all want to have. I've used the word train several times, and I hope I haven't put anybody off with that word. I know it's sort of a strong word, but I truly believe that this path does offer a training ground. It offers an opportunity to work, not necessarily with a clenched fist or a purple face, you know, bearing down work all the time, although sometimes that might be appropriate. But it works, it offers us a system that in a balanced way allows us to work towards our goals. And for me, that's sort of this radical idea that I can give up this idea of a me and a mine, and I can have this happiness that is not connected to whether my husband's been nice on any given day, or, you know, the whatever, the wolf's at the door. I can be, you know, I can be internally happy. I can feel supported inside. And I can tell you this, I mean, I can really tell you this, that I'm no different than any of you, but I've probably practiced a little bit longer than some of you who are new, and this is the Thursday class, and it's really wonderful that you're here. And I can see that as we incline our minds towards these skillful states, they become easier to get to. And that's just a matter of training. It's like piano scales or anything else that we're committed to. The more we practice these things because we want the fruition of them, the more possible they are to go to. Not always, of course. But as we incline our minds this way also, we incline our hearts, and we're not so harsh on ourselves when we don't always succeed. This path really all comes together. So I feel really supported in the Dharma as I work on these mind states, which I'm working on, you know, these unwholesome mind states and these wholesome mind states every day, all day. And I think that this faith in the process of it underlies everything now for me. It really underlies my marriage. It really underlies my parenting. It really underlies taking care of my aging parents. It really underlies being in a very, very busy and intense work environment and commuting really far over the Bay Bridge. It really underlies the sweetness of sharing a cup of tea with a friend, or holding a baby animal or a baby. It underlies all of these things. And so I feel, you know, really, really enthusiastic, and so really, really happy that I'm allowed to share this happiness that I feel with this path with you, because I think it's really an amazing thing. But without right view or right understanding, we wouldn't necessarily make the effort that it takes. And effort is the key word here tonight. There are four efforts. I really searched for some support in the texts for this talk tonight, because it's not something that intellectually I've really read a whole book about or anything like that. And I was really happy to find on a website Tanisaro Bhikkhu's article about the four right exertions, he's calling them. I think they're on BuddhaNet probably. I think BuddhaNet, if you know that website, it's really great. And I'd like to read to you a little from what he's written in that article tonight. And the thing that really impressed me the most is that he has written that each person has their own tools to work with these efforts. In other words, there's nothing that you can take on as prescribed about these efforts. That each person uses their mindfulness to get close to the mind state, to investigate the mind state, and figure out what's the best thing for them to be using in this time, at this moment, with this particular mind state. You know, how do we work with it? And in that way, I really feel empowered to do my own investigation, to not try and do it some way like you always have to do this when that happens. It's more like, well, what works for me? You know, when I have an unwholesome mind state, can I get close to it, really close to it? Can I not worry about it too much, but really touch it, you know, really rub it and investigate it and see under what conditions does it arise? Under what conditions is it sustained, and under what conditions does it pass? And similarly, of course, with the positive mind states. You know, when they arise, can I allow myself to really just get close to them and really investigate them? It's a real active process, this process of meditation. It's not just sort of watching things happen and spin out, but the energy of investigation is what we're really trying to develop, to really see things as they are and to catch them as they arise. So mindfulness is really important, and we're learning mindfulness meditation, so it comes in pretty handy. I'd like to just read you a passage from an article from Tanisaro Bhikkhu about this. Perhaps the most important point in developing right exertion is to realize that the effort to abandon unskillful qualities and to develop skillful qualities must be skillful itself. Unskillful efforts at eradicating unskillful states, even if well-intended, can many times exacerbate problems instead of solving them. Treating hatred with hatred, for instance, is less effective than treating it with the kind of understanding developed in the second stage of frames of reference meditation, which sees into causes and effects and learns how to manipulate causes properly so as to get the desired effects. So for this reason, the basic formula for right exertion includes, both implicitly and explicitly, other factors on the path to ensure that the effort is skillfully applied. Three of the qualities that activate the mind in these exertions, desire, persistence, and intent, are also members of the basis of power, where they function as dominant factors in the attainment of concentration. The ability to discriminate between a skillful and an unskillful quality, implicit in all of these exertions, requires a certain level of mindfulness and discernment. So I think that pretty much is pretty clear and really helpful. He talks about all of these levels, all of these aspects of how we work with these states that are prescribed in the texts. We've talked about them so far. We've mentioned abandoning them, like letting go of a mind state. And sometimes, of course, we can approach something that's unskillful. Like, let's say a couple of weeks ago, I had a pretty difficult interaction with a girlfriend. And I was so happy to find that in the moment that it was happening, I could really see that I could bite this woman so hard. I was so tempted. I just wanted to bite her back. She bit me, and I really wanted to bite her back. But I thought, well, what good would that do? I love this person. You know, I don't want to bite her. So I removed myself from the situation. And we've sent words of loving kindness back and forth over the internet, and I'm sure we'll actually be able to verbalize them any day now. But the point is, so it's a little bit of a happy ending to that one. The point is, that abandoning, that choosing to do something else, which we call what, that's substituting, is a possibility in those moments. There were also the qualities of tolerating them, knowing that these things come and go. I mean, everything comes and goes. So if we're really stuck in a feeling, not to panic, it's not going to be the final state of our life. And when I was a kid, every time I would get hiccups, some smart aleck would say, you know, I read a story about a guy who had hiccups for 27 years, you know, and I was, oh my gosh, is this going to be the time that they just don't stop? But they always stopped. Likewise, with these negative states, they come and they go. However, what's completely important for us to know is what we incline our mind to and what we allow really sows the seeds for what's going to come back. In other words, if we incline our minds to always being angry as a response to something, then we're going to find that it's easier and easier to just get angry about stuff, even stuff that you wouldn't have thought should make anybody angry before. It's just the natural way you might move. Likewise, you might know someone who, irritation is one sort of characteristic you see. Another one would be anxiety. If every time a thought arises, you can figure out a way to feel anxious about it, then more and more that's a way you're going to address issues. And it almost becomes like an ego, an identity thing. You know, this is who I am, attached to these mind states rather than understanding these visitations and the groundwork we lay. So you really see that in my previous lifetime here many years ago as a psychotherapist, and you would see that people would come in just really actually very, very deeply connected to their mind state, because that was a form of identity, and it's scary to let go of things. So relinquishing and letting go is a tough thing to do, even though we know we want to try and do that. Underlying all of this is the idea of karma. Underlying this idea that what you reap, you sow. And this is what I'm talking about, that, you know, if you lay down these negative mind states, if you're not working to uproot them, they can have a potentially a very, very serious effect. If you're always angry or edgy, people might not want to be around you so much. You feel lonely. That's, you know, an obvious one. And you don't have to believe in the next lifetime to understand the consequences of engaging, of allowing your mind to be engaged. But Buddhist doctrine takes it a little bit further and suggests that this does condition, if you want to go there, the next experiences that we're going to have in this human body and maybe afterwards. You don't have to believe in any of that. I don't know it to be true. But I can imagine, I feel like I've had so many incarnations in this lifetime that imagining them later on, this doesn't blow my mind in any way. It's just sort of like I can really see that laying down things now have an effect further down the line in my life. So, likewise, you know, we've met these people prone to anger or irritation or even paranoia, narcissism. Likewise, we've really had wonderful engagement with people who are kind, who are thoughtful, who are wise, who treat people with respect. I feel like we are so fortunate to have a teacher here at IMC who demonstrates these qualities of mind and shows us that, you know, to be a regular human being in this world with these qualities is absolutely possible. Without any particular pretense or, you know, anything. It's just a possibility. And of course, We see in our visiting teachers these capacities, and we see in each other, which is even, in a way, and just it's so wonderful that we can have these moments of engaging with each other in these ways. Abhidhamma, or in Burmese, the Abhidhamma, is that Buddhist psychology which talks about how mind states work. And the Abhidhamma suggests that in every moment, in every millisecond, there are thousands of opportunities for a mind state. They just go so fast, you can't see them on a movie reel, they'd just be gone. But it also suggests that only one mind state can arise at a time. So we have the sense that things are going like this, but it's just because we can't drop in to each and every mind state. And the reason I mention this is because having this sense that only one mind state can arise at a time sort of offers a prescription or a remedy for a mind state, because we know we can take this mind state and make the next one different. We have that possibility. We have that option. Of course, it's hard to act on all the time, but that's what we're training ourselves for. That's why I call it a training. It's not just a happy experience. It's, you know, it's pleasurable sometimes and it's work sometimes. So, and the Abhidhamma says, or the Abhidhamma says, that as we set up these mind moments, they have fruition down the line. So, if not today, tomorrow, whenever. What we wish and aspire to also is really important. Our intention is really important, because even when we fall short, you know, I aspire to be a nice guy all the time, but I'm not. But I aspire to that, and if I'm aspiring to that in my engagement with you tonight, even if I fall short, you know, even if I actually unintentionally cause harm, it's less negative than if I actually want to wish someone harm and go for it. And we see this, you know, we step on bugs, we say mean words when we're trying to be nice, you know, at times we're not perfect, we're learning. I was really fortunate in the early years of my practice to sit several 10-day retreats with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg, and they talked a lot about employing effort in meditation practice. And I really liked the way they described it, you know, the sort of not clenching too hard and not being too lazy, that finding a balance is really, really important. And I really always remembered one of Sharon's analogies, and it was eating steamed vegetables. And what she talked about was both the aim and the effort required to have a fork or chopsticks or whatever you eat with and get that broccoli on your fork. You know, you have to have enough effort. First of all, you have to have enough mindfulness to know that's the broccoli. You know, that's what you're going for. And then you have to have the effort that it takes to aim and get it and eat it. If your effort is too hard, she says, you know, your fork will hit the plate and shatter everything. It's a big mess. If you're so lazy that your fork is sort of going like this and you can't, you know, manage to maneuver your craft, you're going to be missing all the food and you're not going to be very well fed. So effort really becomes necessary in not only sort of working with mind states when we're off the meditation cushion, but certainly when we're on the meditation cushion. And that's, I think, why right effort is found in this third tier of the Noble Eightfold Path under meditation and concentration. How many times, you know, have I sat on this cushion and found myself having a daydream or a plan or something and think, oh, 5 more minutes of this. It's okay because this is really important. You know, this one really, I'll be back to it 5 minutes, but this one is a juicy one or this one's really entertaining. How many times also have I said, oh, daydreaming, disengaged from the content of it and pulled myself back to the primary object over and over and over again. Each time we do it, it's practice. Each time we do it, it's deep practice. Each time we do it, we're conditioning our minds, you know, to achieve our goals. It sounds so simple. It's so radical, really. Sayadaw Upandita, a Burmese Sayadaw, in his book In This Very Life, talks about 3 kinds of effort in meditation practice. He talks about the effort required to establish meditation practice, like the effort it takes on an incredibly hot day to get in your car or get on your bike or whatever and come here, the effort it takes to decide, I'm going to try and set up a meditation practice, I'm going to go find a teacher. The effort it takes to make a practice in your life the best you can, and it's always changing, and it can develop. So this he calls the launching effort. I really like that. The next effort he describes is that he calls liberating energy, and that's the energy needed to work with the obstacles, the hindrances, and we'll talk about that in a minute if you want. It's so if we're bored or lethargic, will we summon up the energy we need? I've really felt lately in my practice, and for a while, that I'm fine-tuning an energy system while I'm meditating. Like if I'm feeling lethargic, which I often do because it's sort of an outcome of concentration practice, and I'm like feeling woohoo, I know I have to rev up my motor a little bit and try and focus more and aim more at things so that my mind is more engaged. A lot of people have a different experience, which is that they get so tense because they want to get it right. And so if that's the case, can we find that in our bodies and relax? Because that's really not all that helpful. It's just a form of aversion to feel bad about what we're doing. You know, we don't want to engage in that mind state. So, and the final effort that he talks about in the meditation practice is he calls progressive energy. And it's that energy that arises as you've been sitting on your object and you're really there with it. And it's the progressive energy that allows for deeper and deeper insight into these qualities, into these aspects of things, like things are constantly arising and passing away. It's that understanding that it's not really personal. It's those vipassana insights that lead us to liberation. I call that, what I label that progressive energy is being in the zone. And I used to tease my Sayadaw in Burma. It's like, oh, today I was in the zone. Well, how many minutes? Well, not very many Sayadaw. Okay, we'll go back and sit in it for 2, 3, 4 hours. Okay, I'll try. But you get a sense of when you're there with something and it's not a big struggle to stay on it. And those are good times to work at really just trying to hold your mind on that object. So those are the energies that Sayadaw Upandita has discussed. And he says that the application of these successive levels of energy allow for the continuation of investigation and protect us from retreating in the face of the hindrances. I want to give us some time to ask questions, and I haven't gotten very far with this, but what kind of advice are we given to reduce the unhelpful, unskillful mind states, and what kind of advice are we given to stick with them? These are all like, what kind of common, practical things can we all come up with together? And I'm really hoping that now that many of you have been here for 4 weeks, you'll have something to add to this conversation at the end of my talk. So I'm going to try and end in another 10 minutes. A while back I mentioned that in the Abhidhamma, the text state that only one mind thought can arise at a time. So that offers this prescriptive behavior that we can substitute, or we can really challenge a mind state. We can decide that we're going to just sit there and really, really work hard at continually putting it aside if it's a negative one. One of my favorite professors in graduate school, Margaret Singer, was a psychologist who oftentimes, she worked with trauma a lot. And she'd say at the end of a session, she would say to someone who obviously was not finished with their work, just take everything and package it up and put it aside. And it'll be there next week. Don't worry. Next time, we'll be able to deal with it. And I often say to myself in meditation, you know what, Kim? You can just wrap this one up and put it aside. It will be there. But this isn't what you're doing right now. You don't need to do this right now. I'm not mean to myself. I'm lucky in that way. I can just sort of kindly say to myself, you know, not now. Just get back to your object. And having that visual image of being able to sort of package something up, you know, is nice. It's also really nice to be able to blow it up, you know, if you can, to use that energy of just utter, you know, fire and say, okay, enough of this. And I loved what Cheryl said a couple of weeks ago about what Thanissaro Bhikkhu said, you know, if this is a movie, would I be paying to watch it? You know, I mean, it's like, is this so important? So there are all these ways in which we can challenge these things. A yogi really needs to use wise discrimination and understanding what's the best method right now. Maybe it's just sitting with it. Maybe it's bearing it and really allowing it to be close so we can really see it for what it is. Not jumping off so fast, but really, really getting up close to it. Maybe it's saying, okay, I've done that enough. It's time to get back. And your gate offers sort of an energy of dissipation to it. It's really kind of unusual. Let's see. All right, so we've talked about all this stuff. I'm going to move on here, because I really like to get to this idea of developing and sustaining. Inez talked about developing the positive mind states last week, and we want to sustain them. So how do we go about that? I mean, how do we go about sustaining positive mind states or skillful mind states? And again, I think it all comes back to being able to use our mindfulness to really see them. And when they arise, are we present enough to see them as they arise? What is it? What constellation of factors has come together? How does it feel in our bodies, you know, these mind states? We're talking about the pleasant, the positive ones now, the skillful ones. Where do we feel it? Is there a clarity that comes with it? Is there a joy that comes with recognizing them? And then, of course, when they disappear, do we know where they went? You know, are we able to just hang with those well enough to be able to see? Could share the Dhamma, you know, even though it's anxiety producing to sit up here, it's also just such a joy to be able to do. That increases that mind state of true gratitude and happiness. Let's see, what are some of the other ones? The training periods that were allowed. I'm talking about formal retreats in our tradition. In those situations, we have the quiet, the space, the solitude, and the good teaching to be able to get close to mind states and see how they arise and pass. And if we can see an unwholesome thought coming, we can learn to work with it so that we can dissipate that energy some. So I would say a formal retreat, if you haven't done a 10-day retreat, I'd highly recommend it, because it's challenging, but it's wonderful. I mean, the first couple of days are tough, and they may all be tough, but they're also wonderful. They may also not be tough. I mean, people have different temperaments, and the Buddha said that some people have sort of painful but quick progress. Others have sweet but long progress to get where we're going. We're all different. You know, it really, we're all moving. There are, you know, training periods in other cultures, in other religions, like the Lent season in Catholicism, where people are asked to, you know, nowadays people give up some bad habit for Lent. And my daughter, who moved to New Orleans right before Katrina last year, has all of a sudden a whole bunch of Catholic friends. So Maya called me this Lent and said, "Mom, what are we giving up for Lent?" And I said, "Well, honey, we're not Catholics. What are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, I think we should give something up for Lent, and I think you should become a vegan." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm a vegetarian, and I do eat, you know, milk products and eggs sometimes. I just don't think I can do that. But I'm going to give up harmful speech for Lent." And she said, "Oh, Mom, you're going to last 5 minutes." Well, that's not very positive speech. So I really focused during that whole 46 days on this aspect of Nisawada, you know, this precept that we take, you know, to use speech wisely and skillfully and helpfully. And it's a great training period. You know, 46 days, not quite enough to last a lifetime, but still, you know, it's an opportunity to review and practice, and I'll do it again. I've learned that, like, in some kinds of training programs, like, for example, Weight Watchers, at the end of 16 weeks, they'll give you a pin to say, "Congratulations, you've stuck with it 16 weeks," which is a training to be mindful of what you eat, really. And even though they don't probably call it quite like that, but they figure in these 100-plus days, you're laying down positive habits. So in our culture, there are other models for this, but these training periods are really, really important, I think, that we allow ourselves that. Some people take a day a week and they sit more quietly, they turn off the TV, you know, whatever. People, this is the joy of this. We get to decide for ourselves and practice and test what we think might work for us. So, just in the last couple minutes, I'm just going to share with you a couple of things that I do for myself. And I'd love to have Gil give us a class, or maybe he has, on some of the things people do to sort of help them prepare the ground for a meditation period or to sort of hold the Dhamma in their life. But some of the things that I've developed, the tools that I employ right now, are a daily meditation practice, which I feel is primary in my life. Willingness to commit to that. And I see in my life its positive consequences and effects, so I do that. And the other thing is, in the mornings, I really like to, I'll have a cup of tea, and then I'll go into my little meditation nook, and I'll say hello to the Buddha. You know, I have this beautiful Buddha sculpture. I'm very lucky. And pictures of my first teacher in Ananda Marga, and my teachers in the Theravadin tradition, and Paok Sayadaw, and my parents, who are aging and with whom I'm really involved. And so all of these things, I look at these pictures, I feel this upwelling of gratitude every morning. I look at the statue of the Buddha, I feel this upwelling. And so I maintain this little table, I like to have fresh flowers there if I can. I like it to be tidy. It's not always, but sort of this like setting up of my own container. And then I sit. Usually I out loud chant the refuges, take for myself. I really feel that it helps me hold what is truly important to me. I take refuge in the Buddha in that sweet, gentle, wise heart of the Buddha. And I take refuge in the Dhamma. All of these teachings that have such an amazing possibility for us to free our minds of greed, hatred, and delusion. And then I also take, the third one isn't as strong for me, taking refuge in the Sangha. It's that group of people who've come before and have been enlightened. But I pay my respects to everyone who's trying to be free. I pay my respects to everyone, period, but especially those people before us who've shown us that this is possible. This is not a myth. These things, we can do this. You know, we just have to keep working at it. I find for myself that it's really important to guard my sense doors. Does that make sense to you? What I mean by that is, I can give you an example. Last week I visited a client in downtown San Francisco, and I had to walk down this street full of these shops. And in fact, this young woman was joking because I was saying, God, it'd be fun to work down here, wouldn't it? She says, no, because I spend all my paychecks on this street. And as I thought, that's too bad. And then I'm walking back and I see this unbelievable tea pot store. And I'm like, oh, wow, I've got to go in there and check out that. And I laughed at myself. I mean, I thought, oh, that's really funny. And I just kept going. But you can see that compulsion, you know, to want something that I've got a teapot. I do not need a teapot, you know. But this compulsion to sort of want something just because it looks so nice or smells so good or whatever, even when you really don't, it's just this drive. And the other way I guard my sense doors is I don't watch TV, you know, not rigidly. Like, I watched a little tiny bit, actually, of soccer with my husband on the TV this morning before work. But, I mean, I don't watch much TV, and I don't watch violent TV. I don't want those images in me. I don't like that. I don't like the way it feels. I don't like the tension it produces. I've had the Chronicle my whole life. I'm from this area. As long as I can remember, I think I learned to read from the Chronicle. But lately, I've stopped reading the Chronicle. I mean, it's so sensational. I mean, you pick up the Chronicle, it's some horrible, I don't even want to go there. Some piece of news that is just not going to be helpful for any of us to be reading about, really. And so, I get my news from NPR. It's enough. It's not, you know, all the grisly stuff that seems to sell newspapers, and all the beauty ads, and all the, you could buy this and be, you know, have this tucked and this sucked and all this stuff. I don't want to go there. But mostly I think what I'm learning to deal with is my expectations, and this is what helps me set these mind states. I'm constantly amazed that I expect things to be different than they really are. I mean, you know, I'm constantly amazed that someone might do something or say something. And I have to laugh at myself. I mean, it's so silly on the face of it, but it's very real in the moment, you know, like, I can't believe this. Well, why not? I mean, these things, everything's happening, you know. So I had a wonderful teaching example of this, and I'm going to end with this. Recently, my husband and I went on a bicycle trip in Canada. Now, I had had the bike 2 weeks before we left, or 3 weeks before we left. We'd been out on it a couple of times. But it's really going to be fun for us to do this bicycling together. And already before we left, it was a big lesson because Paok Sayadaw was in Barrie, Massachusetts this summer, and I couldn't get the time off to do a retreat. And, well, I could have gone for a week, but a week isn't really a retreat with him. And it would have been much better, much more wonderful to have a holiday with my husband, because I've done long retreats the last 2 years, and he's, you know, missed me. So we loaded our bicycles on the car, and we drove to the Washington-Canada border and got on a ferry and went to Vancouver Island. Well, shoot, those islands are made from volcanoes, and volcanoes mean hills. And here I am on a new bicycle with 20-pound packs, because we've left the car in Washington. And I'm like, oh, shoot, there are hills here. How am I going to do this? Well, you know. And it was really interesting to watch how I approached those hills. The first day, it was like this, oh, no, a hill. And then I realized, you know, you're going to make yourself really unhappy the next 5 days if every time you see a hill, you clench down. So what can you do? And what I realized was, although, you know, all those gears they promise you, you keep lowering down and you can just pedal. Well, that's not true. Sometimes you still have to get off your bike and walk. But when you can just let the hills come and go, it's just a great ride. And when you have to get off the bike and walk, so what? It's fine. So it was this amazing opportunity to sort of practice this kind of effort that's balanced and rational and healthy, and not really looking for things to be different than they were. I mean, childbirth is a wonderful experience for people with that too. You know, things are different than you might expect them to be, and you just go with it. That's how it is. So I would like to close now. I'm really sorry I didn't leave us a whole lot of time. Let me just read you one quote. A deva said to the Buddha, "Tell me, dear sir, how you crossed over the flood." And the Buddha says, "I crossed over the flood without pushing forward, without staying in place." The deva, "But how did you cross over the flood without pushing forward, without staying in place?" The Buddha, "When I pushed forward, I was whirled about. When I stayed in place, I sank. And so I crossed over the flood without pushing forward, without staying in place." The deva, "At long last I see an honorable one, totally unbound, who without pushing forward, without staying in place, has crossed over the entanglements of the world." May we all be successful. May we all be successful in working with these efforts and attain the same state. Thank you so much.